There you go.
Okay. Sorry about that.
There's nothing to be sorry about.
Still getting used to it.
All right. So thanks for letting us jump into your morning.
Oh, no problem.
Yeah. We obviously spoke with friends last night. It is a critical part of our job to communicate to you, you know, things that he says and things that come out of it, especially if there's ever anything that kind of has any sort of, you know, time crunch and realistically with the trial date where it is, while we're far from, you know, panic time, every day is important. And so we didn't want to let too many slip by. So thanks for letting us just kind of say, hey, 11:30 tomorrow. It's great you could be available.
Oh, no problem. No problem.
Okay. So let's kind of very briefly jump into our call yesterday. Brent had sent an email sort of saying, hey, can I talk to you guys? I have a question. Tamara and I kind of pre-gamed it. You know, we did sort of say, yeah, this is going to be a jumping off point. You know, he's going to have more to say. And he did. But the primary purpose for the call was this. He has a witness who represents presumably Nation Star or its interests, who is under instruction from his corporate overlords to not travel for purposes of business. His company has told him, you know, until May, you may not move around the country because we're worried about the ability you would have to infect us. So, and that's going on all around. We get that. Brent's request for us was, hey, do you guys mind if he testifies via Zoom, right? I mean, oddly enough, just like this, right? We would have the witness on a screen. Presumably, all of us would be present in the courtroom, but instead of a, you know, witness stand, there's just a television sitting there, and he's appearing in that fashion. And he wants us to know, or he wants us to advise, whether or not you would consent to that. So let's kind of think that through. It starts with the reality that criminal defendants, unlike people in civil lawsuits, have what is called the right of confrontation.
Yes.
You have the right to see a witness, you know, be able to engage with the witness, you know, to challenge them through cross-examination, shake their credibility, and allow a jury to watch them and be able to glean, do we believe what this person is telling us or not? And obviously that right of confrontation, and just so you're, you know, fully informed as you see this discussed, if it ever comes up, there's sort of a seminal Supreme Court case that is called the United States versus Crawford. And Crawford is just kind of the leading guidance we have from the U.S. Supreme Court on the importance of that confrontation issue. And it, you know, it reversed a pretty substantial conviction for Mr. Crawford when the government tried to introduce some evidence kind of in a backdoor way, and the Supreme Court said, nope, you needed to have that witness present in court.
Absolutely, right? Yeah.
So let's kind of talk through the two possibilities, right? Possibility A is obviously we say, sure, that's okay. Go ahead, no big deal. And then we get the talking head on the television. The pros and cons for that are, you know, the con is whatever lack of ability we have to challenge this individual is probably limited somewhat. You know, were that the, you know, accuser in a rape case, would I ever even consider it? No, you know, but this guy's a bank dude. You know, so, you know, he's going to say bank dude stuff. What is the pro? There is probably one big pro, and that is we assure that the trial date is maintained, right? Because we can do that in the March timeframe we currently have set. So let's then look at the other path. What happens if we say no? We won't consent to that. Brent's response is probably going to be to file a motion saying one of a couple of things. Judge, I have this witness. Here's this circumstance. I've reached out to the defense. If we're following this path of discussion, the defense has said no, they will not consent. And Brent is then going to ask for any one of a series of options, okay? Option A is probably, Judge, you can make this guy come. You know, you are a federal judge. You have more power than his corporate handlers. Tell him, tough shit, you've been served with a subpoena, be here.
Absolutely.
I think that's probably the least likely of the three to happen. And there's some, you know, there's case law that kind of says judges really shouldn't drag people from other states during a pandemic. Option number two that's available to the judge that I'm sure Brent will outline will be to say, you know, Judge, balance the equities. Balance the equities of Mr. Higgins's right to confrontation against the needs of the pandemic, and just tell him, sorry, right? Sorry, Mr. Higgins, the court is going to allow this, right?
Mm-hmm.
The third possibility is, and I think there's some likelihood of this, that the court then says, well, okay, Mr. Higgins, you know, you were given the opportunity to be flexible. You chose not to be. This is a critical government witness. You know, I'm going to extend this trial date.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I should say there's a fourth possibility, though I would put this in the unlikely realm as well. And that is the judge tells Mr. Tabachi, sorry, dude, you know, the government's ability to prosecute crime, you know, falls prey to constitutional requirements. You know, sometimes the government has witnesses die. You know, what's the judge going to do? Order them brought back from the dead? You know, sorry, government, you lost the witness. Whatever happened in the world or history, so be it. Let me jump back to the middle two quickly, because it's worth saying that either of those two options, either the court overrules us and allows him to appear via video or grants the continuance, I think whichever way the judge goes, that creates what we call an appellate issue, right? That's something that were you to be convicted and you were to challenge this case on appeal, which you almost certainly would, why not? It's what's called your appeal of right. That would be the kind of issue that an appellate lawyer would dig their teeth into. They would love a Crawford violation where the judge just didn't have to do it. There was no time constraint. Or the other hand, if they allow the continuance, your appellate lawyer could say, this is now, you know, ridiculous. This time should count for a speedy trial. You know, Mr. Higgins didn't request this. This is a government problem, and it's not a just reason for delay. How would that all come out? I don't know. That's down the road stuff. I follow the general rule of thumb of, you know, when we're negotiating and working things out, I'm as amenable as anybody and more than most, right? Because I'm trying to get things. Once we've dropped into trial mode, right? Once we've sort of committed ourselves to moving forward, well, it's time to become somewhat more adversarial. And so my general thought is typically, you know, subject to, you know, certainly an ongoing balance of the equities. But, you know, if the government says, hey, Paul, this is really hard or difficult for me, I need help trying to convict your client, would you be willing to assist me? My general response is, no, I probably wouldn't. So, you know, my advice to you, and I think Tamara shares this, we've discussed it, is that we would probably advise you to not consent. and allow us to reach back out to Mr. Tabachi and say, we've spoken with Mr. Higgins. He is not willing to waive his constitutional right of confrontation, and kind of let the chips fall where they may. The big reason we're having this conversation is that could very well result in a continuance of your trial.
Understood.
You know, maybe it could be a coin toss, who knows. But before we did that, we needed to make sure that you didn't say, screw that, I don't care how the guy testifies, I want to make sure my trial's in March. But I think the better course of criminal defense is to say, no, I'm not in a position to waive any of my constitutional rights. You guys are going to do what you're going to do, and if it's something I can complain about later, so be it.
Absolutely, yeah. I would lean more on that than, you know, agreeing to a Zoom meeting or agreeing to some type of alternative. Let the judge be a judge, you know? Judge Rose has you know, let him be a judge and let him figure out what he's going to do. I find it interesting that this morning, I don't know if either one of you guys watched or not watched, but looked at the Dayton Daily News today.
I have it. I get it on my phone. I read it.
Yeah, Steve Roush gets to pay $15,000, right?
I got that.
Yeah. So.
And then the green trucking's going to be sentenced on April 14th.
And they're going to pay less than 15. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, so, okay. Yeah. Oh, and by the way, just real quick, Ms. Sack, before I forget. You had told me that the other day when we spoke that the government dropped the wire fraud. Dayton Daily News is still reporting that they added a wire fraud.
I know how wrong the Dayton Daily News is, and I can't control them. That's why I never talk to the news, because invariably they screw it all up.
Well, you and I both spoke a long time ago where you said, you know, giving them a cease and desist. Get my name out your mouth. But they still going to keep my name, and, you know, look, yeah, I got it. It's hard for me to sit there and read Steve Roush after the millions of dollars that he has, and he gets $15,000. He doesn't even get the company. So, no, I got my foot on the gas. Let the judge be a judge. I've got a press release getting ready to go out. It's all good. But, no, I don't want to waive my right.
Okay. Well, we didn't think so. And, you know, of course. Okay. Now, secondly, just let me interject before turning the floor back to Paul.
Okay.
Please don't file your affidavit in the district court, because it's going to be denied. You can't have hybrid representation.
No, okay? this is all for what's his name, Garland. You know, Garland's getting ready to go under on the 22nd, 23rd for confirmation hearing. So I'm getting ready to get him in the mix. So it's independent.
Okay.
Independent of what you're doing.
Okay, you understand. I'm not being critical of you.
Oh, I know. No.
Okay. I'm just saying, please stop filing stuff in your case in the clerk's office.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Back to Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Paul, you're on mute.
How did that happen?
I don't know.
It's crazy.
I don't care about that. So, Sam Brown, just so you know, it's coming. Several important things to discuss in this meeting. Enough so that I'm probably going to follow up with an email. Just again, you know. So this is what we said.
Okay.
And so I'm making notes as we go. We will reach out to Mr. Tabachi and tell him our client is not willing to consent, and we'll let those chips fall where they may. And again, for what it's worth, that is one that we. Agree.
When will that? Would that hearing be on our next scheduled hearing?
No. I mean, it could be added. You know, but I think if we tell Mr. Tabachi today, which we will, we've spoken with Brian. He's not willing to consent. He is going to respond with a motion, and I kind of outlined what I think his motion is going to say. It may not. I mean, it could be just a motion to continue trial. He could take one very narrow tact. But, you know, again, that's what I call a him problem, right? We got our problems. He's got his problems. That's a him problem.
Right.
You know, then how the judge will respond to that will be interesting. We'll certainly oppose it. We'll say, judge, you know, this is a government problem. You know, if they got a witness, they can't get here. Tough shit. you know, the trial date is set. You want to go forward, let's go forward. If they have to do it without a witness, so be it. You know, like I said, if the guy died, the guy died. How is that our problem?
Right.
The court can only do what the court can do. And then, as you've said very appropriately, let the judge be a judge. And he'll make a decision. And it'll be a right one. It'll be a wrong one. It'll be one subject to appeal. We'll kind of see where things shake out. Okay?
Got you.
Let us then turn next to the issue of our defense of the advice of counsel. Mr. Tabachi shared during our call yesterday several things involving his case preparation, including the fact that subpoenas are going to start going out. And what Tamara and I think is he is going to serve subpoenas on a lot of people who, quite honestly, we probably thought might be defense witnesses. And he is going to use the power of the government to the ability he has to get them to provide testimony that's going to aid the prosecution more so than it's going to aid you. Okay?
Now we get the right to cross-examine, right?
Absolutely. And so let's delve into a great example of how that's going to shake out and how the right of cross-examination is going to be useful. Okay, and that is going to be Mike Wright. All right. Tamara and I spoke with Mike a week ago. I think we've shared all this with you. You know, we had what was, you know, probably not a great conversation with Mike, meaning that, you know, we were talking very cordially, but, you know, he's in an uncomfortable spot.
Right.
He had the U.S. attorneys call him up and say, you know, some FBI agents and I are going to come see you and sit down.
Yeah, they met.
I'm sure they did that in the scope of, you know, trial preparation.
Yeah.
And they're certainly entitled to do that. There's nothing wrong or inappropriate with that. But our whole push with Mike was, hey, Mike, we've talked with Mr. Hagan. You know, he tells us that he discussed this civil case with you. You know, hey, I'm in this screwed up situation. I got this guy who stole money from me. And what do you think I should do? And Mike agrees that he said, sue him, right? And Tamara and I love the idea of being able to have you on a witness stand and cast you in a light of saying, hey, this is difficult stuff, right? This is insurance law and various people, and you know, I'm not doing this on my own. I have attorneys. I have people who are giving me advice. And so I sought the advice of my friend and attorney, Mr. Wright, and Mr. Wright said, go ahead and sue him. Now, the critical piece of this is, did Mike know at the time he gave that advice that you were talking about suing someone who was a government informant, an FBI asset, confidential informant, whatever you want to talk about, somebody who was cooperating with the federal government to provide evidence against you? You have shared with us, he absolutely knew that. I told him that. When Tamara and I spoke with him, I very pointedly asked him that question. After all was said and done, I sort of drew a breath and said, Mike, let's be clear. Did you know at the time you gave Brian that advice that he was a government informant? And he stopped and he thought about it. I think he reflected. He replayed the moment in his mind. I think he probably thought through the ramifications either way. And he answered very clearly and unequivocally, yeah, he did tell me that. I did know that.
Well, Dayton Daily News published it. Dayton Daily, I filed that suit March the 6th. Dayton Daily News had published that long before March the 6th.
Understood. And perhaps Mr. Wright's purveying of the Dayton Daily News is going to be subject to cross-examination.
Right.
And we still have to circle back around. We have not spoken with him. But, and this becomes a little bit of a game of telephone, and I'm always cautious about that. But Mr. Tabachi has shared with us that when he and the agents went and spoke with Mike Wright, they asked him that very same pointed question, because they understand the legal analysis and they know how critical that is. And according to Mr. Tabachi, and presumably therefore contained in the 302s of his agents, when they put that question to Mr. Wright, he answered differently. He said, no, I don't think I knew that.
Okay.
Now, that's critical, okay? Because the reason why Mr. Tabachi and his agents go talk to witnesses is to lock in their testimony.
Right.
Because unlike Tamara and I, who can call anybody we want to call and certainly call bullshit on them later, right?
Right.
Hey, man, you told us this. Those agents are going to say, you know, you told us this. We wrote it down. We put it in reports.
Right. 302.
And if he were to testify differently, if he were to say, no, I did know, that places him in some kind of peril. Because unlike, you know, anybody can lie to me. People lie to me all the time. Prosecutors lie to me. Clients lie to me. Other attorneys lie to me, right? You can lie to me all day long. Mm-hmm. You can't lie to FBI agents.
You can. I mean, they lie all the time, you know? So
Fair enough. Maybe my use of the word can't is inappropriate. It bears criminal penalties in some circumstances if you lie to an FBI agent. So we will talk with Mike, but our assumption is going, or my working assumption is he's going to say, oh, yeah, you know, Paul, you guys caught me off guard. I didn't remember it right. I thought about it. You know, I did not know that he was a government agent. And regardless of whether he did or didn't or what's in the daily news, what I think the writing on the wall is, that's what Mike's testimony is going to be at trial.
And keep in mind, Mike Wright, and I've said this on three occasions, Mike Wright's not the one that gave me the advice to go do it. Mike Wright's the one that told me I need to research statute of limitations. That's where the guy on Sycamore Street that I met with. So, I mean, Mike's going to have to lay in whatever bed he's... I'm having lunch with him later on today, so I will make a point to point out to him that he may have some issues, but Mike Wright didn't tell me to go file it. He told me I needed to research, and it was Bill Tolliver as well. I don't know if you guys have spoken to William Tolliver, but
we
it was...
Not, we should justifiably put that on our to-do list.
Yeah.
So, who did? I mean, if Mike, again, Mike was, up until a few days ago, our guy.
Yeah.
Mike was willing to come to court and say, I talked to my friend Brian Higgins.
Right.
We discussed it. I gave him legal advice. I mean, we thought he was going to be a critical witness for us against the witness tampering charges based on the theory of advice of counsel.
Right.
Now, we can call Bill Tolliver, but who is the third individual?
I don't know the guy's name. I know the building.
Well, I'll tell you what. Go back through whatever you can go back through.
Okay.
Notes, research, whatever. If you can provide us with a name,
yeah,
we'll go and interview whomever it was.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was a weird. It's set up weird because it has like 20 different attorneys.
I'm
in.
Familiar with the building.
Oh, you are.
The building is Farish's building. Yeah. We know it.
Oh, okay.
We'll put that in your lap. You go find it.
Yeah,
that.
Okay.
Okay? So, you know, for purposes of our call yesterday, and again, I'm just reporting to you what Mr. Tabachi reported to us. I'm not giving it my imprimatur or saying that it's correct. I'm just telling you this is what Mr. Tabachi told us.
Okay.
So what he stated basically was something to the effect of, Mr. Higgins cannot rely upon his prior attorneys to save him. You know, he basically said, Mike Wright is going to testify in ways that are going to harm him. And I don't know that, you know, that that's necessarily like he's going to come out and sink you. But I think what he's referring to is, we don't think you can put Mike on the stand because Mike's going to say he didn't know the guy was a government witness. Now, quickly on the issue of cross-examination, we can absolutely cross-examine Mike, right? Mike, we talked on the phone. Remember that call? You, me, Tamara. I asked you that specific question, and you told me you knew that at the time. Right? I can hold up a copy of the Dayton Daily News. Mike, are you an educated man? Do you read the paper? Do you follow along with public affairs, particularly those that impact your friend and clients directly? Right. You mean to sit up there and tell me that you didn't know this guy was a government informant when you told Mr. Higgins to sue him? And his testimony is going to be what his testimony is going to be.
Absolutely.
Okay. Mr. Tabachi alluded similarly in regards to Mr. Cicero. Basically said, Cicero is not going to be good for Higgins. And for what it's worth, we think he may actually call these guys as part of the government's case in a way to inoculate us from calling them. Now, we still don't know what Cicero is going to say. Right. Because Cicero won't call us back, right? So it's not hard to read the tea leaves. Right. Meanwhile, Mr. Tabachi is clearly in contact with Mr. Cicero.
Well, they go drinking every day at the Century Bar.
So, you know, they're sitting there, but more importantly, whether they're sitting and drinking together.
Yeah, right.
Or whether he's in his office with FBI agents in a formal interview, right. Which I would be willing to bet you dollars to know that he has been. And he has laid out key pieces of his testimony and had it memorialized as part of the government's investigation so that he knows Cicero cannot testify differently without at least exposing himself to the possibility and or threat of criminal prosecution himself. And it seems that Mr. Cicero, and we're reading the tea leaves, we're not talking to him, but you know, it doesn't take a genius to figure out which side of this debate he's taking. He is likely to testify in ways that are going to cover his own ass. And those are going to be ways that at the very least don't help and may possibly be contrary to you. We don't know. Right?
Okay.
All right. So that's where we are on the attorneys. With that said, Mr. Tabachi then went down what is sort of a very typical government path. One we've discussed before, the one I call showing you the stick. And so he made a series of statements, threats, whatever you want to call them, in an effort to see if this case cannot be moved forward to resolution. And what he said was the following. Please tell Mr. Higgins that next Friday, not tomorrow, but a week. Next Friday is the deadline for plea negotiations. If Mr. Higgins wants to resolve this case along the lines that we have discussed, that's it. After that, I'm going to have subpoenas out. I'm going to be in trial preparation mode. But please let him know that there will be no plea on the day of trial. You know, the only thing you could do on the day of trial would be to plead guilty to the indictment. Something that I doubt Tamara and I would recommend. So he's kind of trying to draw a line in the sand. You know, we've come far enough. I've reached the point where, you know, I'm going to take one last shot at it, and that's that. Now, beyond telling you that that deadline is coming, I don't know that Tamara and I have a whole lot of additional comment. We've talked, please. You've listened to us. Ladies and gentlemen, we have said what we have to say, and we thank you for always allowing us to do that. We are not in the business of arm twisting. We have told you again and again, we will try this case and we will try the hell out of this case. Wow. So the fact that I'm telling you, you know, hey, the government is pushing plea yet again, is again part of the communication. What Tamara and I can never have, and it's part of why this is going to be something worth putting in an email, is a client saying, oh my God, I want out of this. You know, I mean, things have changed. I talked with Mike, he did it, whatever, you know. And we go, sorry, man, the deadline was last week. What we can never have is a client say, you didn't tell me that. right?
Fair enough, so yeah.
Fair enough. Tell you what the deadline is and work beyond it. And for whatever it's worth, he's, you know, tell him I'm going to demand that he be remanded at the end of trial, which means were the jury to find you guilty. You
know, I go immediately into custody, I know.
Right.
Immediately into custody.
Right.
I don't know if Rice does or Rose does that. Tomorrow probably knows his personality better than I do. But it's a possibility, you know, and it's always my job. You know, I've represented people, you know, for years and sometimes, and I'll always tell them, hey, man, if you're ever in risk of not walking out of the courthouse, it's my job to tell you that, right? Today is one of the days you might not walk out.
So I do have a question as it relates to that. Let's assume that I do get found guilty, and I don't know. I mean, I know it's anywhere from 5 to 10 years. Let's assume they start saying like 8 years, 8 to 10, whatever it is, and they take me into custody immediately. When do I begin or have the right to form the appeal? I know you guys won't be on the appeal. Would that be, do I have like a time limit for an appeal?
Yeah.
So here's the way that shakes out. Okay, the conviction, the guilty, right? Even though on television, often, you know, a lot of times feels like the end of the show, it's not, right? In federal court, we actually then just begin what is called the sentencing phase, right? And the sentencing phase in a federal court takes a lot of time. There's a very mechanical and important process for the preparation and review of something called a pre-sentence investigation.
Okay.
Gathers a whole lot of information about you, does an analysis of what are called the federal sentencing guidelines to give the judge a sense of the kind of ranges that are suggested as, you know, again, a sort of an advisory guideline that the court has to consider. And at the end of all of that, and that process will take probably 4 months, you're actually sentenced. So let's just, you know, assume the worst for the moment. You could be in custody during that time.
Right.
Or, obviously, we would say, Judge, this case has been going on forever. This is, you know, a white-collar fraud case. Mr. Tabachi's frustration at having to try this case aside, remanding our client was ridiculous. Right? There are a multitude of defendants who are out in essentially white-collar money cases. Allow our client to remain free.
Yeah, however they do it. However they do it.
In answer to your question, whether you're in or out, someday, let's assume trial in late March, you know, 3 months forward, sometime in, you know, July, August, somewhere in that time frame, you would actually appear in front of Judge Rose for sentence. And at that point, the judge would actually impose the sentence.
Gotcha.
Here is what I'm ordering. All right. And he puts on at that point what's called the judgment entry of sentence. That is the critical document that sort of officially says you have been convicted and you have been sentenced, signed by the judge.
Got you.
That is what starts the clock for your appeal. Now, the appeal is actually very easy to do. And I don't want to jinx us by spending a whole lot of time talking about it.
No, that's okay.
But we would, at that moment,